The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
However, it does so in the absence of racially explicit language. So to be clear, I think we should be rightly outraged and should protest all manifestations of racism. But it shouldn't take the police chief of Wolfboro, New Hampshire, unapologetically calling Obama the N-word, or Donald Sterling going on a racist tirade to establish that racism is intrinsic to every facet of the system. From the moment of contact with police through racial profiling, through the court system on down, a systemic understanding of racism better explains where racism comes from as something carried out by systems, not just individuals, and that is officially sanctioned. We need this deeper analysis, I think, to really understand how we've gotten to the point where a system governed by this insidious, non-covert form of racism has been able to sort of operate in plain sight in a context where the civil rights movement succeeded in making overt discrimination unacceptable to mainstream society, and of course, in the age of a black president. So basically what I want to talk about, I have a couple of themes that I want to go through. Anything I don't get to, you know, of course, we'll take up in the discussion. But I want to discuss how we got to the point of incarcerating more people than any other nation in the history of the world, and how we got to the point where we have more black men in prison on probation or parole than were enslaved in 1850. I also want to get into how the new Jim Crow actually operates today. I want to get into an assessment of the current movement, because there luckily is a current movement. There's a hopefulness of people really beginning to challenge mass incarceration. And I want to talk also about alternatives to mass incarceration, which I think is something that isn't as frequently discussed. How we understand as socialists the limits of reform under capitalism, and how we can actually look to fight for something that sounds very radical now, but I think we need to look as far as a world without prisons. There's a really great book, Angela Davis's Are Prisons Obsolete, that I want to recommend that people check out, that says that much better than I ever could. I would check that out. So for the history, how did we get to the point where the U.S., with 5% of the world's population, has 25% of the prison population? We had, in 1970, 300,000 people in prison. Well, that's nothing. We have 2.3 million in prison right now. So I think it's important to understand how this developed, what drives this, if we understand what drives it, how will we build an effective opposition? And knowing that it's not a predetermined thing, that this was not a foregone conclusion, it's something we can also challenge. Prisons have always worked under capitalism as a means of social control designed to protect the interests of the ruling elite. However, they did not always exist as explicitly racialized systems of control, nor did they round up anywhere near the numbers of racial minorities they do today. In fact, through the 1970s, crime enforcement more closely reflected actual crime rates, regardless of race. That role was played in different periods by different systems. First slavery, then the sharecropping and convict lease systems, and then the Jim Crow system. Thus, mass incarceration is only the latest manifestation of the discretionary application of laws on the basis of race that has been a central tool of the U.S. ruling class in thwarting the possibility of a united challenge to their rule, while also controlling the most repressed populations in society with the most immediate potential to rebel against their condition. Now, I can't go into actually the details of how do Marxists understand racism and the rise of racism or even race itself. And for that, I'd recommend people check out Brian Jones's talk later in this conference, The Social Construction of Race, that's going to be on Sunday. But just a brief overview, Marxists, you know, understand racism not as just like a bad set of ideas or even something that just intrinsically arises between groups of people who are different. It's not human nature. Rather, they reflect and are a product of the way society is organized and works to maintain the rule of whichever elite is in power at the time. They reflect the ideas of the ruling class. I think it was absolutely essential in terms of mass incarceration that this system arose as a direct response to the movements of the 1960s and the threat that they posed to the entire social order. So let's think about the 60s. You had a context where the Black Power movement and the Black Panthers had an enormous audience. They were, you know, Black Marxists. who were actually at the point of shooting back at the police. You had a major anti-war movement and a major civil rights movement, a gay rights movement, a women's rights movement, the Attica prison rebellion, and renewed battles within labor and just an overall social radicalization. That really questioned the legitimacy of this system. And it sort of reminds me of the Egyptian revolution. There's this loss of fear that people were not only determined to question the society, but to actually fundamentally alter it. And the survival of this system was further undermined by an economic crisis in the 70s and also by the Watergate scandal, which turned sort of our purview from a certain type of kind of petty crime by, you know, any old person to the crimes that elites can make on almost a regular basis over against large numbers of people. So these movements and the ruling classes' attempt to regain control formed the context in which law and order and crime prevention became issues of national concern. A systematic militarization of the police force developed alongside an ideological ramping up of racism in response to the civil rights movement and the so-called culture of disobedience. It was not immediately clear, however, that a radical reorganization of the police force and anti-crime policies would form the basis of a new system of racial control. In fact, as Christian Parenti notes in his book Lockdown America, another one people should check out, the major crisis for the ruling class was that the police force was utterly failing to maintain order. During the 1965 Watts Rebellion, the disorganized and non-communicative police forces were actually forced by their protesters to retreat, which, you know, that'd be awesome if we could do that now. That just shows you the level of confidence and radicalization. The postal workers' wildcat strike of the 1970s, they had to call in the army to act as scouts, but the army was so disillusioned by the war effort and all of these things that were happening in the society that they couldn't reliably rely on them to come in and replace the workers. And finally, the Kerner Commission, which was drafted by the government under the Johnson administration, found that in largely black neighborhoods where these massive rebellions occurred, the presence of the police crackdowns had actually increased, not diminished, resistance. So it wasn't working. Thus, representatives of the ruling class faced a central dilemma: how to contain the threat of an organized political rebellion and combat the culture of dissent. So a veritable war was waged against what the government viewed as sources of dissent, complete with military tactics, which were increasingly entrenched into routine police practice, found its primary targets in poor and black and brown communities. The training of the American police force was increasingly standardized and centralized under the auspices of the federal government, which was won through an influx of federal grant money and a steady flow of military equipment to local police departments. The initial targets of this buildup were members of the New Left, the anti-war movement, the Black Panthers, and the independentistas, you know, Puerto Rican advocates for Puerto Rican independence. But the counter-revolutionary offensive also had an ideological component. How am I doing on time?
You're 15 minutes into it.
Okay, great. So the Southern strategy of the Democrats, which linked civil disobedience against racist Jim Crow laws to crime generally, was adopted by Republican Richard Nixon's electoral campaign in an effort to appeal to Southern whites who vehemently opposed desegregation. And they did it by using racially coded rhetoric, not always so coded. Nixon candidly admitted in private that the whole strategy really was, to aim at the whole problem, which was the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to. And I think in many ways that succeeded. This campaign was primarily ideological under Nixon, but it really got its legs under Reagan, who declared the war on drugs of the 1980s, which I mentioned at the beginning. So this was not actually a response to drug abuse or increased crime, which what actually happened was the war on drugs was declared 2 years prior to the outbreak of the crack epidemic. A lot of people think that it was a result of the crack epidemic, but the war was actually declared 2 years prior, which is interesting. His administration launched a media campaign to manufacture crime hysteria and justify tough-on-crime policies at a time when both drug abuse and crime were actually in decline. But what this media campaign really did was to fix in the public consciousness the association of drugs and crime generally with a black face, with the most utterly racist stereotypes you can imagine, and whipping up hatred against this new enemy. I'll just quote briefly. Reagan had this radio commercial, and when I say it wasn't so coded, he says, "The jungle still is waiting to take over. The man with the badge holds it back." So pretty awful. In effect, the prison boom was created as a function not of changing crime rates, but policies that redefined crime and expressly targeted minority communities that were concentrated in impoverished urban centers. In this process, the Supreme Court was complicit at every juncture, from the dismantling of the welfare state at a time of deindustrialization that severely impacted impoverished Black communities, to the immunization of the entire criminal justice system. There's a case, I'm forgetting the name now, I thought I had it written down, but there's a famous case in the 80s that basically said that you can't, it's McClussy versus Kemp, I believe that's it, it said that you need to have intent, a racist intent, in order to prove racism. You can't use statistics, even if, you know, for instance, you have an overwhelming majority of Black people being arrested or targeted or put into prison. That isn't enough to prove racism. You need someone to say the N-word or hang a noose or do something that ultimately shows that they're racist. So what that meant is there's no challenge you can make. It's extremely difficult, and there has not yet been a successful challenge to that paradigm. So the result was that the prison population doubled between 1980 and 1990, and from the 1970 statistic, I gave the 300,000, as a result of pretty much just primarily nonviolent drug offenses, we had a quadrupling of the prison system. And this continued under Bill Clinton. We couldn't really rely on the Democrats to challenge this. They actually took on the strategy for themselves. As one commentator put it, the political survival of the Democrats, or the way they viewed it, was dependent on being more bloodthirsty than the Republicans. So people may know about the case where Clinton actually traveled back to his hometown during the campaign to watch the execution of a mentally disabled man to prove, you know, he's so tough on crime. So sometimes I think he's a lot worse than Reagan. I know people say Reagan's the worst. I think Clinton's much more insidious, but that's just my two cents. So in the same context, there was a retreat of liberal opposition, either because they were wedded to this lesser evil party or literally because of COINTELPRO and the decimation of the radical left. So in sum, the overall effect of these policies was to shift the focus away from the systems that produced extreme poverty, violence, and inequality to the actions of individuals, the people, the culture, etc., who were, according to the new paradigm, responsible for their own condition, as well as a plethora of social problems, from violent crime to unemployment. And all of this warranted a singular punitive response. So funds for rehabilitation were slashed, welfare was slashed, the social welfare state was slashed, we came to a society that claimed to be race neutral, and yet 90% of those incarcerated for drug offenses were Black or Latino. So in many ways, again, Nixon's dream was realized. So how does this work? Racism exists at all levels of this system. As stated earlier, mass incarceration does not function in practice the way it's typically understood as a system of crime control. It's better understood as a system of social control whose primary targets are defined largely by race. In fact, mass incarceration does more to increase crime than to deter it by contributing to the economic destabilization of already under-resourced communities, making the illegal drug trade among the only viable options for income, and increasing the threat of violence posed by turf wars and the police. However, while the choice to target these communities is made easier by poverty, the prison boom has been a function not of poverty or really any concern for the crime facing those communities, but of policy. Despite the fact that drug crimes were committed by all races at roughly equal rates, and where differences existed, actually, every study showed that white people actually use drugs in greater degrees than people of color, the war on drugs still targeted primarily young Black, youth for largely nonviolent drug offenses. As Michelle Alexander stated, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than with the language we use to justify it. We have not ended racial caste in America, we have merely redesigned it. So I should probably skip ahead a little bit. I want to kind of reiterate the fact that this is sort of a process. The police sweeps of the Wall Street investment firms. Well, oh, I don't know why I wrote that sentence. That never happens. There is no such thing as a police sweep of a Wall Street investment firm. There's no SWAT teams invading white suburban communities. And yet it's perfectly acceptable in communities of color, which are often compared to occupied territories because of just how subject they are to police terrorism, that increases the likelihood that people will actually be killed in the offense of this war. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. You know, part of this is due to mandatory minimums applied to drug violations and the fact that these people are really targeted regardless of guilt. I don't think the guilt or innocence of people is really at issue here. It's the criminalization of these whole communities. And this really translates beyond the prison walls to the devaluation of black life from the courts on down. But even someone who serves no time in prison or a shorter sentence loses many of their rights through the prison label. Once labeled a felon, discrimination becomes legal in employment, housing, education, jury service, access to welfare benefits and food stamps, voting, in other words, in virtually all of the areas that it was once legal to discriminate against black people under the old Jim Crow. So the whites-only signs are gone, but a new type of sign has gone up. This discrimination, however, is not even considered part of a person's official punishment for a crime, but is merely seen as collateral consequences. Even if we were to pass laws to reduce time served in prison, for instance, if that was a reform we could, you know, work towards, the prison label recriminalizes and renders one's punishment never complete. The loss of these rights puts an extraordinary barrier to the possibility of re-entering and participating fully in society, while also increasing the likelihood of returning to prison with few options for stability or survival. Sorry, still trying to skip ahead. It's such a big topic, unfortunately. But as I said, this operates beyond the criminalization of the felon label itself. The criminalization of communities of color happens not only directly through the criminal justice system, but extends across a variety of institutions from housing to education. People may have read of that recent study that said that black women are subject to eviction at almost the same rates that black men are subject to incarceration. If you look at the education system, you know, what people call, what a lot of activists refer to as the school-to-prison pipeline, mm-hmm. in a plethora of ways and from an early age, children growing up in largely poor communities of color are taught they're not worth investing in the first place. Rather, they're prepared for and made to feel that punishment is society's normal and only ready response for them, making arrest or incarceration seem like a predetermined fate. And it's expressed literally in the fact that 1 in 3 black men are likely to spend some time under state control. The critical question is, what's driving all of this? Why is this happening? The new Jim Crow, like previous systems of racial control, serves the interests of the ruling class in controlling the most economically deprived and oppressed sections of the population, as well as populations they've deemed problematic or disposable. Today, the 85 wealthiest people control as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion. The U.S. has greater inequality than it has in its entire history. You can't have this level of inequality without a level of extreme repression, particularly of the politicians that the populations that are most likely to resist. From the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement, black people have led every major struggle for equality in this country, and allocating resources to structural reforms that would actually solve the problems that poor and working class people face and that are disproportionately affecting people of color cannot be accomplished without a fundamental questioning of social relations that enrich a few at the expense of the rest of us. The ruling class does not want another 1968. It must provoke and invoke racial divisions within the working class in order to justify its control. And the era of neoliberalism under Reagan ushered in the slashing of the social safety net, social programs, and living wages that have only worsened in their rollback since the Great Depression, or since the greatest recession since the Great Depression. And in this context, the criminal justice system plays an increasingly important social role in killing dissent, and also reinforcing those divisions to any kind of united action. Thus, the ideological function is not just a mere distraction from class issues. We can't understand it that way. It needs to be understood as central to them. The historical context of the U.S. has meant that one is always dependent on the other. And while the privatization of prisons is not the driving factor behind mass incarceration, capitalists' direct investment in stocking prisons with bodies and using prisons as a source of cheap labor pose a greater barrier to dismantling mass incarceration. So more institutions have a fundamental stake in this continuing. And just an example of that, nationwide, 63,032 inmates produce more than $2 billion worth of products a year, most of which are sold to government entities. So it's incredibly profitable, and of course they're earning a pittance. I think the lowest is something like 15 cents an hour, something crazy like that. And moreover, even though the targets of mass incarceration are young black men, the machinery of the new Jim Crow can be turned on other populations that have been deemed problems. The violence of the prison system intersects with other forms of oppression under capitalism to create particularly egregious conditions for women, who are the fastest growing prison population, women of color, LGBTQ identified people. And in the post 9/11 period, that machinery in New York, where I'm from, was turned against the Muslim population through the NYPD's demographics unit, which luckily was recently disbanded, was also turned against the Occupy movement, and increasingly at border states against immigrant populations. So this role of social control is really quite critical, and it's not just about people of color. It can be turned on a lot of different people depending on the needs of capital at the time. So I want to talk a little bit about the current movement. I know I'm running short. What remains a hopeful sign is that the shifting public consciousness around the barbarity and racism of mass incarceration and the idea that it constitutes a new Jim Crow has created enormous potential to build a mass grassroots challenge. The current national landscape suggests that we are already at the beginning of this fight back. So you can take note, for instance, a number of inspiring initiatives. There have been 11 states and 61 counties and municipalities across the country that have passed Ban the Box initiatives, the box that you have to check if you're labeled a felon on job applications. And usually you can't get a job if you do this, or even an interview. And on education, also on college applications. There's been a major challenge to the stop and frisk and stand your ground policies that really reinforce that criminalization and are part of the driving force behind it. And recently, if people know about the Central Park 5 case in New York, there was a $40 million settlement, which was the largest in New York state history for any wrongful conviction. So that's a major victory, and that would not have happened if it weren't for this mass shift. And it's really against remarkable odds. And it's also driven by people who are directly affected by the system. There's an organization called All of Us or None that people should check out that is made up of formerly incarcerated people. And another one called Worth, Women on the Rise Telling Her Story, that advocate for formerly incarcerated people on their behalf as people who are directly experiencing that system. There are other things that I could get into that I might have to save for my wrap-up, but I think there's some serious challenges that we need to discuss in terms of how we move these things forward and limitations to what we can actually do under capitalism. So these are important beginnings, but even if we were to actually dismantle mass incarceration altogether, it would really have to be on the basis of an interracial anti-racist movement that also demands economic justice. Short of this, given the centrality and the adaptability of racism under capitalism, we cannot otherwise guarantee that the ruling class won't erect a new system to enforce racial division. Thank you. Yet another challenge to our movements is the threat of co-optation by would-be liberal reformers within the two-party system who would limit the scope of our demands. For example, recently, the mayor of New York, Mayor de Blasio, and he was the one who basically endorsed the Central Park 5 settlement and has been driving some reforms of stop and frisk, though not an end to it. But that's alongside the appointment of Bill Bratton, who's this absolutely he's this absolutely racist, like fear-mongering, horrible person who's now the new chief of this administration, or of the police chief. And under Bill de Blasio, there have actually been more stops than there were under either Bloomberg or Giuliani, who drove the initiative in the first place. So this is our would-be liberal reformer. Similarly, while Obama may have actually allowed the word race to escape his lips when he launched the My Brother's Keeper initiative to keep young black boys on track, his administration is also funneling more military equipment to local police departments. And so all that will do is increase the surveillance and crackdown on these communities. A full victory must treat the driving forces that ensure more cases like this won't occur. And these are precisely the issues that politicians are unwilling or unable to touch. For this reason, we need an independent movement that cannot be muzzled in making the necessary demands of the system that gives rise to mass incarceration and asserts a critical understanding of the overall function that mass incarceration plays and how it impacts all of us. To start, I think it's especially critical that the voices of those who are most affected remain central to this fight. And I would like to just take a second. I'm almost done. It's like 5 minutes. I just want to take a second to read the platform of the Formerly Incarcerated and Convicted People's Movement, which is a really another great organization to look at. There's a 29-minute radio documentary. Again, if you look this up, that really, you know, they say with you know, some real power, speak on their conditions and on what they faced and their efforts to challenge that system. But I think that this platform is especially powerful because it links the efforts to improve the condition of prisoners and formerly incarcerated people to a broader long-term effort to dismantle the new Jim Crow and the conditions that create racial inequality. So that platform is these points. One, we demand an end to mass incarceration. Two, we demand equality and opportunity for all people. Three, we demand the right to vote. Four, we demand respect and dignity for our children. Five, we demand community development, not prison profit. Six, end immigration detention and deportation. Seven, end racial profiling inside prison and in our communities. Eight, end extortion and slavery in prisons. Nine, end sexual harassment of people in prison. 10, human contact is a human right. 11, end cruel and unusual punishment. 12, we demand proper medical treatment. 13, end the incarceration of children. And finally, 14, free our political prisoners. So achieving these demands would be a major victory, and I think it exemplifies something that Angela Davis points out, which is the need for our reforms to actually, you know, improve the lives of people, but also, and also that reaffirm their dignity, which is, I think, part of what these things do. You look at every little aspect of what's taken away from people in this context, and it's just horrifying. It's dehumanizing, and I think that's why these things are important. But at the same time, we need these reforms to be geared towards a fight that injects a broader vision of the sort of society we need. Ultimately, we must fundamentally challenge the priorities of a society that relies on prisons, mass incarceration, militarization, inequality, and racial division at its core. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.